on the table, more than once it came up, either what do you do, some variation on that question, or how's it going? That is, we're asking this question. It doesn't take long when we get into a conversation with one another. Who are you? And before we kind of get very long, you know, we're sitting next to one another on the bus, we're relative strangers, but as we get to know one another, we start to ask the question, and what do you do? And somebody might push back and say, well, don't ask me what I do, ask me who I am. And I say, that's just the cover. In actual fact, what you do matters terribly to you. The same principle applies for our God. There's a song that we used to sing. I don't think I heard it very much recently, but it was a song that used to go, it went like this. God, we worship you not for what you do, but merely for who you are. And you were supposed to kind of sing it with a kind of a deeply spiritual tone, as though somehow you'd moved into another level or elevation of spirituality. Beyond what God does, I only worship God for what he is. And I just want to look at you and say, well, what God is it you're worshiping? The only God we know is the God who has created all things and is redeeming all things. Every psalm celebrates God as creator or redeemer or both. That's who we worship, the God who does good work. And then, as extraordinary as it seems, God then invites us in like manner to do good work. So I ask you the question, what is the good work to which you have been called? I'd like to suggest that perhaps you only have to answer this question once in your life. Perhaps in your late teens or early 20s, you wrestle with the question, what is the good work that God is calling me to? And then you're kind of good to go for life. And I say, dream on. For the fact of the matter is, we live in a very fluid world, a fluid economy, a fluid circumstances in our own lives, and we're going to be asking this question again and again and again through the course of our lives. And we're going to be in conversation with others, and rightly so. Older men to younger men asking the question, what is the good work to which I have been called? We're going to be in conversation with one another as peers and as friends. Indeed, one of the most substantive conversations you will have with another person will be around this question, what is the good work to which you and I have been called? This morning, what I'd like to do is to suggest that when you ask that question, you consider that the answer is found in response to the Spirit's prompting in your life. That you learn the capacity to lift up your heart, to use ancient liturgical language, and attend to, Spirit of God, what is the good work to which you are calling me at this stage of my life, my work, my career, and my ministry? In conversation with others, O Spirit of God, I want to be tender, I want to be responsive to the circumstances of my life, but most particularly to you. And if you were to ask me, Gordon, help me answer this question, I would, rather than answering the question for you, I would ask you six other questions. That is, in order to get at the question, what is the good work to which you are called, I would ask you the following six questions. Question number one, what on earth is God doing, in brackets, that catches your attention? I'll begin there. What on earth do you think God is doing? That makes all the difference in how you understand your work, because our work is a participation in the work of God. More on that in a moment. Secondly, I would ask you this. Who are you? I would ask you the self-identity question. I would urge you to take a sober look at yourself. Thirdly, I would ask you, what is your stage of life? For we wrestle with this question, what is the good work to which we are called, in very different ways if we are in our 20s, in our 40s, or in our 60s. Fourthly, I would ask you, what are the circumstances of your life? Because God's call is always located. The phrase that I'll use tomorrow in the sermon is the phrase from the book of Esther, for such a time as this. Vocation is always for such a time as this. It's for now. What are the particulars of your life into which God is calling you? Fifthly, I will ask you, what is the cross you have been called to bear? On the conviction that when Jesus bears his cross, he turns and he says to us, take up your cross and follow me. And my contention there is that the cross intersects every vocation. And then finally, I would ask you this question, what are you afraid of? And suggest that indeed the greatest obstacle to your capacity to fulfill your vocation is internal to you, not external. Those are the six questions I'm going to walk us through this morning. Here we go. Number one, when you're in conversation with yourself, which may sound like a form of mental ill health, but we talk to ourselves all the time. Or when you're in conversation with another and you're wrestling with the question, what is the good work to which I or we have been called? It has to begin, to use technical language, theocentrically, in a God-centered way. We need to ask, in a sense, the prior question. Before I can know what I am called to do, I need to know what on earth is God doing. Because, you see, our work is but a participation in the work of God. This applies to all of us. If you were to go visit a farmer friend of yours and you drive up the driveway and you see that something has been planted, and as you pull up to the driveway, you can't quite make out what it is that's growing here, so you ask your farmer friend, what are you growing? A true blue farmer would say, what do you mean, what am I growing? I plant, I water, in due time I hope to harvest, but it's growing even when I'm sleeping. I'm not the grower. Who's the grower? Of course, God is the grower. A farmer is not a grower. God is the grower. What a farmer does is participate in what God is doing in bringing this seed to harvest. My doctor, Art Harper, is a doctor here he's in the city of Vancouver. When I moved to Calgary, I moved to Calgary at a stage of life where if you've got a good doctor, you stick with the good doctor. We're going through life together. So I visit with Art Harper here in Vancouver twice a year. He's a superb physician. A number of years ago in my previous job assignment, I got a rather severe parasite visiting down under in Mexico. Came back and met with him, and he thought maybe he needed to bring a tropical medicine specialist in, but in due time, he figured out what the problem was, and he took me through a regimen that took 3 months in order to get me healed. And I jokingly told him when I came back, you are a healer. Well done, well done. You're a healer. He just recoiled, of course. He says, don't call me a healer. He's a man of Christian faith. He says, no, Gordon. And I knew where he was going. He says, no, Gordon, God has healed you. I still thanked him, but what Art Harper would recognize is that he participated in the healing work of God. Every preacher knows this. We know that when we preach or when we teach, the real transformative work is done by God. We don't have the presumption to think, whoa, we bring about transformation in the lives of God's people. Not for a moment. All we are doing, and my point is that in actual fact, every job either participates in God's creative work, God's redemptive work, or both. That in a very real sense, our work is a participation in the work of God, and therefore we ask the question, what on earth is God doing? But here's the challenge that we have on this. Many of us come from religious subcultures or backgrounds where the assumption is that the Lord's work is religious work. And when I use the phrase Lord's work, I'd love to say it the way my father would say it. And it's kind of like a three-syllable word, the Lord's work. And Gordon, we must be about the Lord's. I can't do it, but anyway, I'm trying. You must be about the Lord's work. And what did my father mean by the Lord's work? He meant religious work. And most specifically, work that was focused around the life and witness of a congregation. And a Christian was a mature Christian if you were, and I quote, active in the local church, because that's the Lord's work, and we must be about the Lord's work and not be distracted by what? Secular work? Other work? Distant work? Work that doesn't really matter to God? But could it be that God is calling women and men into every sphere and sector of society? That God is calling people into business, into education, and into the arts? And that the transformation of our communities is as women and men embrace indeed the ways in which they have been called to be active players in what God is doing within our societies. And my question to you is this, do you have a vocational imagination wide enough to incorporate the ways in which God is calling you to be a participant in God's kingdom purposes within the society of which you're a part? In my previous job assignment, I was involved actively working with a number of agencies to reestablish a theological seminary in Hanoi in Vietnam. And there were six agencies involved. I was the president of what is called Resource Leadership International, and I was playing the pivot role between these six agencies, some of them working with the government agencies, some of them working with church agencies, and so on, to reestablish a theological seminary, a Christian and Missionary Alliance seminary, I would say, that had been closed in 1952 by Ho Chi Minh, and now has been reopened. But in my first visit to Hanoi, I went to church three times on that first Sunday. Went to the Roman Catholic Church, St. Joseph's Cathedral. It was packed, really surprised me, at 7 a.m. I went to the Tin Lan Church at 9 a.m., which is the Christian and Missionary Alliance Church, also packed. And then at 11 a.m., I went to the Hanoi Christian Fellowship, which is the expatriate English-speaking congregation. And I'm intrigued by these churches. I used to pastor an international church in the Philippines. So I was intrigued by this church, and I wanted to know who these people were. Clearly, the people around me, worshiping with me, around in my immediate vicinity, were English was not their first language. That is, English was the lingua franca as people came from all over the world, and I'm curious, who are they and what brings them to Hanoi as they worship on Sunday morning in English, but it's just the common language between us. So afterwards, I asked one of the members of the pastoral staff, so who are these people? And his response was this, almost verbatim. He said, about a third of these people are involved in kingdom work. And I'm thinking to myself, what does he mean by kingdom work? Because, and what are the other two-thirds up to anyway? You know, so I say, meaning, what do you mean they're involved in kingdom work? Well, they're here under cover. That is, they have a business visa cover in order to do church planting and evangelism. Some of them are involved in relief ministries and development ministries, and presumably those are kingdom people. So I said, fine. And what are the other two-thirds doing? You'll need a seatbelt for this one. Well, he says, of course, Hanoi is the capital, so we have a lot of people here from the embassies, from around the world that are serving in the embassies here in Hanoi. We have a huge business sector, and indeed, Vietnam welcomes businessmen and women into their country. And then we have a lot of people involved in education, teaching in the universities and so on, because Hanoi is the intellectual capital of Vietnam. I was speechless. Are you telling me that those three didn't fit under your category of kingdom service? When will we get it? When will we get it? Frankly, I am not convinced yet that the denomination of which I'm a part really gets this in their gut, that we really get it, that God is calling you into every sphere and sector of society. God is calling people into the arts, into business, into education, to become indeed salt and light within the social fabric of the communities of which we are a part. And if you don't have an imagination that's that wide to encompass all the ways in which God may be calling you, you'll miss it. And we also tend to be a little bit kind of dismissive within our religious subculture of manual work. Maybe it's our cultural influence. That somehow if you work with your head, that's cool, but if you work with your hands, well, that's a little menial. Menial and manual come from the same root word. Interesting enough, isn't it? That indeed menial labor is lower level work, but could it be that some of the most significant ways in which God is making a difference within a society is through those who work with the trades, carpenters and electricians and plumbers, and all the diverse ways in which we learn to work with our hands? Indeed, it intrigues me that in Proverbs 31, in the celebration of the woman who's the noble wife, her hands are referenced 5 times. It intrigues me because I think the author of the book of Hebrews is making a point that handy work is noble work, it is good work, and it is a means by which we can bring glory to God. Does your vocational imagination incorporate all the diverse ways, potentially, in which God is at work in a society and in a community? Think back to your family of origin. In my growing up, my father assumed that if you loved Jesus, you would go into religious work. It's perhaps okay to be a pastor, but the default should be to be called into international ministry. And so this was drummed into us as kids, that indeed God's highest calling is international ministry. Almost the idea that the farther you go, you know, like from this part of the world, it'd be, I think, Mongolia or Sri Lanka. I don't know where, if you'd get a thread out on the globe. The farther you go to the regions beyond, we must go. And if you can't go, well, then at least be a pastor. And if you can't be a pastor, then at least make enough money to support those that are pastors that are doing the Lord's work, that are doing real work. And I need to ask you the question, in your growing up, what was the default for you? What was the religious culture of which you're a part? Did it have a broad enough imagination to incorporate all the ways in which potentially you might be called to make a difference for God and for his kingdom? Where do you get the affirmation, the nudge, the encouragement to embrace the call of God without presuming somehow that there's a hierarchy of vocations? It was interesting, that language that I've used a couple of times this morning came to me a year ago. I attended a consultation put on by InterVarsity Christian Fellowship with Asian Americans. And I was the old guy in the room, the only person of Asian descent. And we had people, Korean Americans, Chinese Americans, Indo-Americans, and Korean, Chinese, Indo, and Vietnamese Americans. So these four were in the room. I mean, they're all in their 30s. And this group of young people was just huge fun to spend this 2 days of focused concentration with. And they were the ones saying that within our communities, we do not have we have a very narrow band when it comes to our vocational imagination. Our parents assume we're going to be engineers, lawyers, or doctors. That's the range of options you have. Even business is somehow lower. Even arts are lower. Pastoral ministry is lower. It is all lower. Those are what parents lean into their children. Those are your options to these young people. And apparently for the Korean Americans, they were all teasing one another. But for them, it's the toughest, whatever that may be. I don't understand all the social dynamics there. But the point is this. What was it for you? And are you now at a stage of life where you can say, Lord, open my eyes to see what you are doing in my world so that indeed I can embrace it to your glory? A year ago, just about this time, I was preaching at Southview Alliance Church in Calgary. And I get it. Maybe you do that here at PCC. I get it when at an Alliance Church, as part of our morning worship, we put up on the screen the photograph of one of our, what we call them now, international workers. I struggle, actually, with that designation. I think people called into business, people called into the arts, people called into global education work, they're all international workers. But we use the language international workers for those who do religious work internationally. That's what we do in our denomination. And we profile them. And Southview Alliance Church profiled this couple without specifying where they were because we need to be discreet, because they may be in a country where it's not necessarily overt and public that they're involved in religious work. And we prayed for them, and I think this is very good. I get it. I grew up as the child of missionary parents in Ecuador. I served as a missionary with the Christian and Missionary Alliance in the Philippines. I get it. Except for this. On any given Sunday, some of the most significant things that God is doing are happening through the people that are right here. That is, business people who are making a substantive difference in the way that a business is thriving and families are thriving who are supported by that business. On any given Sunday, there are public school teachers in this congregation. And I think, whoa, they have perhaps one of the biggest challenges within our society. And oftentimes, they're the only Christian within the public school in which they're teaching. I think of artists and people involved in media, and I begin to think how significant these people's roles are within a society, within a community. And I ask this question, do you as a church believe in them as much as you believe in your international workers? I plead with you to recognize their significance, their power, their level of participation in what God is doing within our society. That is that the kingdom purposes of God are fulfilled through each one of you as you embrace the call of God upon your life. I ask you the question, what on earth do you think God is up to? What is the work that you are called to do? But the prior question to that is, what on earth is God doing so that you can see and feel, and I actually use the word feel intentionally, feel the force that of what you're doing is actually participating in what God is doing in your community, in your society, and in your world. Second question. Six questions I'm going to ask you. The second question. Who are you? Now, this second question is terribly important. Don't dismiss it. Because in actual fact, just asking the first questions can sometimes get us very excited about what God is doing in the world. A little over a year and a half ago, Joelle and I were out here in Vancouver. We have fallen in love with the Calgary Philharmonic Orchestra, but we still have a particular affection for the VSO, for the Vancouver Symphony Orchestra. So without letting anybody know back in Calgary, we were out here for a weekend and we went to hear Beethoven's Ninth by the VSO at the Chan Center. Unbelievable. I mean, it just was over the top. I'm having a Pentecostal moment there at the Chan Center with the VSO doing, you know, Beethoven, and you think you've heard Beethoven's symphony so often, but when it's done brilliantly well, it is just simply incredible. Afterwards, we walk to the car, and I sit there in the Chan Center parking lot, and I don't start the engine right away. And Joelle turns to me, and she says, I know what you're thinking. I said, yes. I missed my calling. I should have been a symphony conductor. That's me. And I remember as a kid, I used to do this. I conducted Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture on these black vinyl. Young people, you have no idea what we're talking about, but there's these black sheets that we used to put on top of things and would go around and it would play music. And as a little kid, I would conduct the entire, I know this thing as a child. I know Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture, and you would think, my goodness, I'm called to be a conductor of a symphony orchestra. And I think that maybe in the kingdom that is yet to come, I will have at least one opportunity to conduct either the CPO, the Calgary Philharmonic, or the VSO, or some variation on the thing. But then Joella very nicely says, well, Gordon, let it go, because you're really, it's really not you. And she didn't need to put it quite so bluntly, but it was just like, that's not you. And so, well, okay, you know, it's not me. And she's right. I can revel in the VSO and realize that that, in many respects, is not me. Even now, as the president of a university, I have these little moments in which I walk down the hall and drop in on Kyle Jansen's office. Kyle Jansen's the program head, the chair of the department for our history department. I did my undergraduate degree in history, and all of my favorite profs were the history profs. And Alexander Zagorin was the head of the history department. I viewed that as a university student, I viewed that as the highest possible calling. I mean, there it is, you know, chair of the history department of a university. I didn't even know there was a dean or a president. I don't know what these people did, but the chair of the history department, I was in his office often. That's what I wanted to do with my life as an undergraduate. In my fourth year, I felt a call into ministry and kind of diverted from that. But when I went to be a pastor of the Alliance Church in Peterborough, Ontario, I didn't know how this was all going to turn out. So I kind of went down the road and I signed up for an MA program in history at Trent University, you know, just kind of to kind of cover my options down there, and thought maybe this ministry thing isn't really me. Maybe I'm really a historian, so I kind of better keep that going over there. And I remember the day that John Gilchrist, the head of the history department at Trent University, said to me, you know, this isn't really your calling. And he was not a Christian believer. He just said, I don't think you're a historian. Ouch. And I'm halfway through this MA in history, and he just says, I don't think you're a historian. And now, as it happens to be, I have some very close friends who are historians. Bruce Hindmarsh, for example, at Regent College. Nick Terpstra, he's the head of the history department at the University of Toronto, perhaps my closest friend. These guys are historians. And when I tell them this story, they say, whoa, that was close, Gordon. Oh, no, you're not a historian. Okay, thank you. But just kind of, you know, naming the reality, you might say. Some of you know my son, Micah. He serves as a pastor of the Alliance Church in Portage, Manitoba, but he used to be an intern here, and so some of you might have crossed paths with him along the way. He went to UBC in his first year out of high school, and he did very well in math. He was really strong in math and in science, and high school counselors, if you're good in math and science, they kind of, you know, shepherd you along to say, well, then you must be an engineer. So Micah went to UBC and did engineering, and, well, it didn't go so well. He struggled studying engineering, partly, I think, because of the sheer size of UBC, but I didn't know all the issues, and I didn't want to probe, but I knew that he was struggling. About halfway through that year, friends of ours, Brian and Ann Solomon, they had worshipped in the church where I was a pastor in the Philippines, and they're from Adelaide, Australia. And they were visiting here in the Lower Mainland, here in Canada. I was teaching at that time, or I was serving as the dean at Regent College. Mike is at UBC. They came to our home for dinner. So there were the five of us are, Joella, myself, Brian and Ann, and Micah. We're having a lovely dinner, but after a while, clearly Brian wants to ask Micah. Now, Brian is an engineer. He's an engineer's engineer. I mean, that's what he does. He worked for the Asia Development Bank, putting up major facilities for them. This, I think of as the quintessential engineer. So I thought, this is great. This is good for Micah to be, you know, talking to kind of like a real engineer. This is a very good thing because his father, like, hello, isn't. And let's see where this conversation goes. So Brian very gently, just winsomely, starts to ask Micah about studying engineering at UBC. And some probing questions, some raising questions, what courses he's taking, what are the strengths of the program, what are the things that you're particularly enjoying, what are the things that you are particularly find challenging, and the conversation's going back and forth. But there's a tenuousness to the whole conversation. Joelle and I and Anne are quiet, while Micah and Brian are engaged in this conversation. And then finally, Brian just stops, and he just says these words, Micah, you're not an engineer. And I just said, could somebody please pass the B5? Whoa, this is very, very awkward. I thought, wow, the audacity of this older man to say to the younger man, you're not an engineer. And you know, I think what was powerful in that is Micah said, these words, I know. Okay, I'm thinking about what this cost, which was perhaps the wrong place for the mind to go. But anyways, be that as it may, I thought it was a distinctive turning point for Micah. A year ago, some of you may know, he went through a crisis of pastoral ministry at a church here in the Lower Mainland. Now he could start to think, is this me? Is this what I'm called to do? And he talks to three men. One of them's right here, Brian Buehler, Daryl Johnson, Mark Buchanan. He talks to these three men, and all three of them, in a variation on the theme, say, you are one of us. That is, the difference is the older man blessing the younger man and Micah embracing his identity, his calling, where he is indeed being called to participate. That is, it's not that engineering is not good work. It's not that being a historian in the chair of a history department is not good work. It's not that conducting the VSO is not good work. It's that this isn't me. It's not who I have been called to be. And thus, what we need to do is not merely ask the first question, what on earth is God doing? We also need to ask the second question, and who am I? Because I cannot discern my level of participation or the way in which I'm called to participate in the kingdom purposes of God. I cannot discern that if I am not clear about who I am. Self-knowledge, Romans chapter 12, take a sober look at yourself, is an essential part, and frankly, probably, I almost want to say the biggest obstacle to discerning your vocation is self-knowledge, but I wanted to save that line, the biggest one, for later on, so I'll save that. The second biggest one, no, I don't know. But anyways, you get my point. As often as not, when somebody can't figure out their calling, and I'm in conversation with them, and I'm realizing it's because they're not willing to accept, with humility and grace, to name the reality of who they are. May God grant you this grace, to stop wishing you are anybody other than who you are. For what it's worth, it's wasted energy, because you can't do anything about that. I didn't know how to break that to you, but that's it. This is it. This is who you are. May God grant me the grace to stop comparing myself to others, to stop wishing I was anybody other than who I am, and look, I'm not an English prof either, to look at myself with sober judgment, according to the measure of faith, Paul says, Romans 12, that has been given to you, and then embrace the reality of who you are to the glory, to the greater glory of God. What is the way in which I, not just any arbitrarily, but I have been called to participate, and thus to ask the question, who am I? To look at yourself with clarity. I published a little book called Courage and Calling quite a number of years ago, and in that book I identified four questions that you can ask of yourself in order to get at the heart of the matter, who are you? And I kind of picked up those four questions by reading different books on vocation and so on. But after the book was published and it was kind of gone to the press and out and in the marketplace, I changed my mind, which is really kind of awkward. You know, you want to write a quick note to everybody who bought the book. Could you please send this to them that page 42, the author has changed his mind. I don't know. What you do, other than that a number of years later, the publishers, InterVarsity Press, asked if I would revise the book. I said, happy to do that. I really want to fix this one part. That is, what happened over the years, perhaps it's just a matter of growing older, walking around this question, what is the good work to which I am called, was the realization that in actual fact, of all the questions you might ask yourself, I think Peter Block is right when he says the most fundamental question that you need to get at is, what is it that matters to you more than anything else? What is it that matters to you? And Block's suggestion is that indeed what matters to you reflects the ways in which you have been wired, like few other ways of reflecting that. That this, in a very real sense, and I mean it almost pun intended, gets to the heart of the matter. What is it that matters to you? When I went to the Philippines, I was really deeply convinced that I was to be, Joel and I arrived there in 1982, and we were almost in a sense alarmed with the lack of adequate theological formation for pastors in that country. So it wasn't long before we were invited, and I was invited, and I became a participant in Alliance Biblical Seminary there, and I was invited to teach theology and other courses, and I got involved in teaching, and I realized I really loved doing this. I love teaching. After a while, they asked if I would be the dean because, Well, the dean was going to go on a furlough leave to the United States, and would I fill in for a year? I said, no, I'm a teacher. This is what matters to me. This is what I really think I should be doing. They said, well, would you just do it for a year because, well, there's no one else. It's not good for your ego, but, you know, you want to be a helpful person. So you said, okay, I'll fill in for a year. But after a year, in fact, just before the year was done, Tom Wisely, who had been the dean, announced that he was not coming back after all. So I said, well, you guys need to get on with looking for a dean. But something had happened during that year. One thing was I had done the work quite well. The other thing was I realized that I, not only did I feel fairly good at doing this, it mattered to me. And so when Rod Tano came, the president came and asked if I would continue, my first response was to demur. But he was very wise in his observation. He says, Gordon, you get this. You understand why it matters. And I think your colleagues would really like you to continue in the role. And as I did, I began to realize that governance, administration, the management of institutions matters to me a lot. Maybe not to you. In fact, maybe people like me, for whom this kind of thing matters to them, you look at them somewhat strangely and weirdly, that these people maybe need help. But it's who I am. A few years later after that, Joel and I were visiting. I was teaching at a place called the Schloss Mittersill. It's the Mittersill Castle, the Schloss Mittersill in Austria. And after the end of that, we took the train from Schloss, and we were going to be flying out of Zurich. We took a train into Switzerland, and we were going to change trains in Switzerland, just over the border, for the train that would take us to Zurich, and then out, we were flying out, as I said, out of Zurich. And we arrived into this town on the other side of the border, waiting for the train, our connecting train, to come. And I made the observation that the train was scheduled to arrive at 11:55 and leave at 11:59. Now, sometimes these things, you know, you just think, you know, why not just say 12 noon? You know, why say 11:59 that it's going to leave? I mean, what's a minute? And I just thought, you know, this is ridiculous, but I'm going to watch this thing. It's going to arrive at 11:55, is it? Here comes this massive train. You can hear it coming from 11:50 onwards. And it's slowing down. And I'm watching up on the pier, on the platform, this massive analog clock that they had, almost like a sculpture, as the second hand is ticking, ticking, ticking. And this massive train's coming from my left, and I'm watching this thing to my right. And when the second hand hits the top at 11:55, it goes, boom, this massive machine, whoom. On the second, unbelievable. We jumped on the train. Joel normally gets the window seat, but on this particular occasion, I asked for the window seat so I could look at this clock thing. And everybody else seems to be relaxed and everything, but I'm kind of nervous. I'm going to watch this thing, this phenomena known as the Swiss rail system. And sure enough, again, here we go. The second hand's coming up to 11:59 to the second. And when it hits the second, you could just feel the entire train just shift. And I wanted to break into the doxology. Unbelievable. A thing of stunning and absolute beauty. And my wife saying, Gordon, have you even seen the Swiss Alps? Like, what difference does it make if it leaves now or a minute from now? And I just say, you know, deal with your own stuff. This, for me, is like, this is beautiful. This is a beautiful thing. And I am that kind of a person. I got off of a flight yesterday, and I go out to Avis, and there's my name, and they're expecting me, and they have the car that they know I like to drive, and Avis, and if you work for Hertz or Budget or National, sorry, but just for the moment, I'm trying to kind of affirm the whole industry, not just this particular one, but if you work for Avis, hey, well done, guys, and I thank them. And when there's a well-run business, when there's a well-run agency, when there's a well-run government, it matters to me. And partly, perhaps, it was the experience of living in the Philippines, where I observed routinely bad, poor management and governance, and saw indeed how people suffered because there was not good governance, how the people suffered because they did not have good leadership who cared for the diverse ways in which an institution or a government or a country work. These spheres of influence matter, frankly, to all of us, but for some of us, it matters more. One way to get at this question, and it's a potentially tricky way, but I think one that merits at least putting out there, is to ask this question. What is it that makes you angry? What is it that makes you angry? Now, the problem with that question is that you cannot live as an angry man and expect to do productive, good, and fruitful work. If anger drives your life, it will destroy your life. It's like a hot coal. It will sear you. It will cauterize the vitality of your heart. You serve out of joy, even regardless of what it is that God is calling you to do. Having said that, sometimes asking the question, what is it that makes you angry, is a way of getting at what matters to you the most. Now, if you get angry when you get cut off in traffic, I want to just say, you know, maybe you should leave the car home. You know, maybe take public. You know, if that's the kind of thing that makes you angry, and I don't mean this unkindly, so, you know, just, but grow up, you know. I delete that. I should have built up to that and framed it better. But, you know, it really is infantile anger. That is, what makes you angry because you know it makes God angry? Well, people cutting me off in traffic, I think the Lord is against this kind of stuff. Well, maybe so. But I think you get my drift. That what makes you angry actually is a way of getting at the heart of the matter, of what it is that cuts to the very core of who you are. That could it be that what God is calling you to do is because you've indeed recognized that this matters, and your anger becomes a window into what it is that matters to you perhaps more than anything else. Having said that, let me repeat what I said, because this has to be said. Anger cannot drive you. It will destroy you. Anger cannot be that which energizes us. To use the masterful phrase from the Holy Scriptures, the joy of the Lord is our strength. This is what anchors, animates, and fuels us, not our anger. I'm only referencing anger as a way, potentially, as a window, as a way to get into what it is, who it is that I am, and what it is that matters to me. And then, if it matters to you, so help you God, do it well. If it matters to you, learn the art, master the art of doing this. That is, I'm suggesting that mastery, that skill development, follows what it is that matters to you. That you develop the skills to do what matters to you because it matters to you, and you want to do it to the glory of God. If you're called to teach because you believe in the transformative power of kindergarten, elementary, high school education, then so help you God, master the art of doing it well. Develop the skills that go with the art of doing it well. If you've been called into a line of, whatever the line of work that God's called you to, if you're going to do it to the greater glory of God, you need to master the art of doing it, and doing it to the very best of your ability, as Paul says to Timothy with respect to his work as a teacher and preacher. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. I'm going to talk about midlife for now. But third question. Question number one, what on earth is God doing? And if I were going for a walk with you, because you asked me to come alongside, I would be very loath to use the phrase should, the word should. You should think this way about the work of God. Rather, I would listen. I would want to know, what is it about what God is doing that has captured your imagination? Secondly, I would want to be assured that you have a significant measure of self-knowledge. And self-knowledge means that you don't have to be anybody other than who you are. You don't have to be any other persona. You need to be you. Then thirdly, I would ask the question, what is your stage of life? Because as I said a few minutes ago, we wrestle with matters of vocation, work, and career very differently in our 20s, in our 40s, and in our 60s. And it's helpful, in a sense, to ask, how does a typical 20-year-old wrestle with the question, what on earth is God calling me to do? A 40-year-old and a 60-year-old, and the comments that follow, I'm going to be very brief, but at least it will give you an idea of what it means to be at that stage of life and at least signal that your stage of life makes, not just a difference, a very big difference in how we wrestle with the question, what is the good work to which I am called? The biggest question for a young person, and as the president of a university, that's 80% of the people in our university are between the ages of 18 and 23. They're moving from adolescence into adulthood. That's, in a sense, the context and setting. Our seminary students tend to be in their mid-30s. That's the average age. But for the typical undergraduate, they are making the transition from adolescence to adulthood. And without doubt, the biggest question they're wrestling with is, who am I, pregnant pause, as over against my parents? Who am I, not before them, but before God? One of the things that's very different from my undergraduate years is that every fall we have student orientation for all the new students. When I was an undergraduate university student, I went to university on that first day by myself. My father did not come. My mother did not come. Inconceivable that they would come. Now the times have changed. Now when we have the orientation for new students, I stand out in the driveway, the entryway to the university, and every car coming up, almost every car, has three people in it. The new prospective, you know, student, she are here for their first year. They're coming for student orientation. They're going to move into the residence. And who's behind them? Who's driving the car? Who's lugging the suitcases? Mom and dad. Here they all come. All three of them show up. It's a very different day than it was a generation ago. So they all show up, and we have then new student orientation, and we also have parent orientation. And this is a very interesting exercise, and as the president, I get a chance to speak to the parents. And I have kind of a standard speech that I give, variations on that speech, but we have different members of the administration assure them about everything from campus to security to the quality of the food in the cafeteria to everything. I mean, they have a myriad of questions. And then I give my little talk about, that is entitled, the title of this little talk is Go Home. I know there probably is a better way to frame this, but it's basically, that's the talk, a variation on the theme of Go Home. You need to go by the finance office on your way out to the parking lot, if you don't mind. But basically, this isn't going to work if you don't go home. That is, what you need to do is let your daughter and son have some psychological and spiritual distance. But for that, they need to have geographic distance. And I'm struck by this, that oftentimes I see, especially the women students, not so much the men, but especially the women students, they're on the phone all day long. And I think they're talking to their friends. And then I realize, no, their friends are right here. Of course, you're thinking they could still be talking to them even though they're right here. It's a whole other issue. But as often as not, they're calling mom. The umbilical cord is still just going very, very strong. And I almost want to go up and take the phone and say, can I talk to your mom for just a minute? to say, you know, you're going to have to, the cell phone has made it too easy for these hovering parents to kind of be fully present. And while they need to be supported, I don't question that for a moment. And while we need to be, as an academic community, supportive of these young people as they make the transition, the fact of the matter is, this is a crucial liminal time in their lives in which they say goodbye to mom and dad and now ask the question, who ultimately has final authority in my life? Who ultimately has the final say on the work to which I am called? Who ultimately defines my identity, my sense of self-worth, my sense of purpose? And you all know the answer. What we long for them to do is, regardless of the academic program, whether they're in biology or business or Bible, I don't care what their major is, either way, at the end of the process, there needs to be a sense in which now they have become an adult before God in their own right. And they recognize that indeed that the Lord of glory, the risen one of the universe, is the one to whom they owe final and ultimate allegiance and authority. And that their parents, God bless them, and I use that not in any pejorative or kind of satirical way, God bless those parents, are now freeing their sons and daughters to embrace the identity that they have before God. This is not easy. I remember sitting at my father's kitchen table and telling my father that Joel and I were called to the Philippines. He was not happy. You would think he would be thrilled. But no, his goal for me was to be a missionary to Latin America. I speak Spanish. And it was a very hard exchange, but it was a necessary exchange. He eventually came around, bless his heart, but I wish it hadn't been so difficult. And for what it's worth, I never felt my siblings actually managed that transition as well. For whatever it's worth, I was able to do so. Those of you that are older, part of what indeed the power of parenting well is ultimately to free our sons and daughters to be who they are called to be before God. Did you hear me? But then the reverse is true. I want to say to these young people, it may be tough to go home and tell mom and dad, I'm going to be an engineer. I'm going to be a carpenter. I'm going to be, this is what God is calling me to be. But your ultimate allegiance is to the Lord of glory. If you never get that, who your ultimate allegiance belongs to, you'll never thrive as a Christian. It's ultimately, it is the pivotal question that every Christian ultimately needs to ask. Who is Lord of my life? Then midlife. When does this come? I suspect that developmental psychologists are right, that probably midlife happens somewhere between our mid-30s and our mid-40s. We make the transition. It'll be different for different people, but my sons, ages 36 and 38, are already showing both the body size, weight, and configuration of a man moving into midlife. That was meant to be very funny, thank you. And the sensibilities of men that are moving into midlife. And now you're realizing that, yikes, they start to realize that, as Andrew says, I'm the same age as Joe Thornton, and he's about to retire. They know now without any doubt that they're not going to play for the NHL. If there's any doubt, the Canadian dream, it's gone. It's been gone for a long time. But that's representative of the following, that now you know you can't be just anything you want to be. Now you're going to make some focused choices. Now you're going to recognize that, no, not every option is available to me. But rather now, and going back to my earlier question about who are you, now it better come to clarity. I think it's pretty hard for a 22-year-old to ask the question, who am I? I haven't lived with myself long enough to know who I am. But by the time you get to your mid-30s, you've lived with yourself long enough to know what you've done well, what you've done poorly, what you have failed at, and perhaps even be able to answer the question, what is it that matters to me more than anything else? That is, now it's time for focus. But it's also the time for skill development for most vocations. I have two granddaughters. They used to worship at this church. Both of them, when they were worshiping here, were involved in gymnastics. Now Karis, age 9, if she were to go into gymnastics, would not make the cut. She's too old. Apparently, you have to make a decision a little bit earlier than that. Unbelievable. I remember Michael Jordan, the second greatest athlete of his generation. I say when I'm on this side of the border, same era as Wayne Gretzky. When I go south of the border, I say the greatest athlete of his generation. I'm very astute politically that way. But some of you who are both basketball fans and baseball fans would know this story, that Michael Jordan, it kind of crossed his mind, having mastered basketball, being the greatest basketball player of his era, he decided he was going to give a go at baseball, which is just like, okay, how hard can this be? He's the greatest athlete of his generation, and he's going to try to play baseball. And then the op-ed page that I read about this after he did not succeed made the observation, you either learn how to hit a curveball at about age 19, 20, 21, or you never learn it. That's when it has to be learned. That is, there's a sweet spot, in other words. There's a sweet spot in your vocational development when now this craft needs to be formed, reformed, formed and reformed again and again and again because you do it again and again and again and again until you learn to get it right, until you master the art that God has called you to. And as you move into your late 30s, I plead with you that whatever habits were part of your habits as a young man, that those habits that were habits of lacking discipline, lacking focus, and in our age of distraction, this is a particularly great challenge, that you decide, this is what God has called me to do, and I'm going to be good at it to the glory of God enough that I'm going to master it, and I'm going to turn off the cell phone and do it again and again and again. For those of us that have been called into preaching and teaching, you just simply, I mean, one of the gifts that was given to me was to get to go to Peterborough, Ontario. And I had to preach 3 sermons a week, Sunday morning, Sunday evening. Can't believe we had Sunday evening services. What were we thinking? Sunday morning, Sunday evening, and Wednesday evening. I had to preach a sermon on Wednesday evening for the prayer meeting as well. I was preaching 3 times a week. It was ridiculous, except for this. I was doing it again and again and again and again. And by the time I had left there, after 4 years as a missionary going to the Philippines, I had preached upwards to 1,000 sermons. And I have no illusions that these were good sermons. Not at all. What I recognized later on was that I had done it again and again and again, and each time resolved to learn from the experience of having done it. That is, midlife is a crucial time in order to test the waters, who am I, but also then to master the craft to which I am called. And in this regard, it's in midlife as often as not that we learn to recognize what it is we do well and what it is that we don't do so well. And I'm not using the language of weakness. I'm using the language of strengths and limits. Who am I? But also, who am I not? Which takes me back to my earlier point then, that we come to a stage of life when we stop wishing we were anybody other than who we are. We just come to the humility of self-knowledge and also of self-acceptance. And for what it's worth, what this means is that we can celebrate the other. We can celebrate the skills and abilities that have been given to other, so that your talent and your capacity is no threat to me. If anything, your talent and your capacity actually enhance me. They're not a threat to me. Still working on that one, for what it's worth, but I still believe it. Question number four. Question number 3C. I didn't quite finish question number 3. My brother-in-law is Métis. When I turned 55 at my birthday event, he kind of announced, "Gordon, you are moving into your eldership." I said, "What do you mean I'm moving into my eldership? I don't think so." He says, "Oh yeah, no, in the First Nations community, you are now an elder." I said, "I'm not First Nations." "Oh," he says, "well, you could if you wanted to." I said, "I don't, so I'm good." So then when I turned 60, he says, "Okay, Gordon, now you're moving into your eldership." I said, "No, still not yet. It's later on for those of us." But what the joke, the conversation that we have had has tended to be around the idea that somehow that as we get older and we ask the question, so when do I make the transition into my eldership? When am I a senior within the community? When am I an elder within the community? When am I not young adult or mid-adult, but senior adult? When I was first writing on this whole topic, I assumed that by the time you turn 60, you need to start making the transition. I've since changed my mind, and I think probably it's closer to 65 or 70. That was meant to be funny, people. Work with me on this. In other words, the kids go older the closer I get to it. Or could the other alternative be this? That in actual fact, we view, and for him, for Al Henry, my brother-in-law, for him, it is a sign of deep honor. This is something you want, Gordon. Why do you resist it? And I think in some ways we've been wired to think that growing older means you're less useful, less loved, less significant, less indeed present. Could it be that in actual fact, the very reason why we are born is that we would ultimately be elders within the community, that we would grow older and we would grow riser, and rather than resisting our senior years, actually learn to embrace them? The fact of the matter is, I'm 63, and there's no two ways around it. I am moving into my eldership. And even in the words that I'm about to say now, I serve as the president of a university in a very different way at age 63 than if I were 43. I serve with, there's no doubt about it, I'm one of the oldest members of the faculty. I serve as one of the senior members of the community. There's just no, it is what it is. And I don't try to be any younger than I am. This is who I am. I'm an older member of this community. I'm an elder. I'm not a senior citizen, but I'm without doubt an elder within the community. Meaning what? Well, it means a variety of things, but no doubt, the older we get, we become more aware, using the language of Psalm 78, generation to generation, that indeed, as we get older, we tend to look now back over our lives, and we recognize that part of the role that we have, the older we get, is to pass on wisdom and blessing to the generation that follows us. The part of the role of the senior within a community is indeed to be a source of wisdom, of mentoring, of consultation for those that are younger. One of the things that grieves me about many of our religious communities is the lack of intergenerational dynamic within them. I say often to young men, your only hope to thrive in your life is if you draw wisdom, strength, encouragement, and blessing from those that are a generation older than yourself. I use the image of Elisha, who grasped after Elijah and said, "I will not let you go until I get the anointing." I see Paul and Timothy in the opening verses of 2 Timothy, the older one to the younger one. Micah was telling me about a sermon he preached during the Advent season, but why did Mary go to Elizabeth? She went to Elizabeth to get her blessing. She needed it. I had not quite seen that before. That indeed, we cannot fulfill our vocations as young men without the blessing of the older man in our lives. And if we're not part of intergenerational communities, we do not know. We do not have the experience. I spoke last March in the residences at the university. We have their floor meetings every Wednesday night. They're held at 10 p.m., which explains, I think, the sleep deprivation of our students. Because by then time, I'm a senior citizen. I'm ready for bed. But they asked me to come in once a year to each of the floors. So each year I go in, I give a brief talk, and then I ask questions, and we pray together, and I go home. Last year I decided to speak on this whole question of intergenerationality, older men, younger men, blessing, wisdom, and all of that. And then I said to them, there's supposed to be 12, but there were 14. Some guys came from other floors, I guess, because I was there. They asked me, I said, now I'm going to go around the room, and I'd like each one of you to tell me, who are the older men in your life, apart from your father, who are significant men in your life? Just their source of wisdom, grace, blessing. First guy said, oh, I don't have any older men in my life. I wasn't surprised, but I thought, okay. Next guy, no, he said, there's no older men in my life. You know where I'm going with this? We went around the room, and every one of them said, they don't have any older men in their lives. I was stunned. I walked out of there just almost numb as I walked to my car, 22 below zero or some crazy thing. And then as I'm about halfway across the parking lot to my car, a young man is calling to me from the door of the residence, and he's running towards me barefoot in the middle of the winter night. And he comes up to me, a man of Asian descent, young fella, and he just says, would you be my mentor? And I'm thinking, this man is just desperate for an older man in his life. That is, when we are not intergenerational, we leave, in a sense, people rootless and anchorless. And those of us that are older, part of our calling is to be present to the next generation as an instrument of blessing and wisdom. But this will find particular expression in our senior years. And thus, rather than retirement, I'm not sure if there's a better word, but rather than retirement, there needs to be a refocusing of my life. There's no doubt there's a transition that is coming. There's no doubt I will not be the president of Ambrose University indefinitely. There's no doubt I'm already beginning to see that indeed a transition is on the horizon. And when I make that transition, I will be asking the question, now, Lord, what is the good work to which you are calling me as an older man? That is, I will qualify it that way. It will look and feel different than the question I would have asked in my 20s and in my 40s. Now, as I move into my senior years, what is the good work to which I am called? It would be riskier to say what I'm about to say if it was early fall or late spring, but I struggle with the number of snowbirds that leave our congregations here in Canada, kind of abandon them for nicer climates down in Arizona or Florida, wherever it happens to be, and abandon the faith communities of which they're a part. That is, that the older senior citizens kind of abandon the intergenerational communities, and I say, but part of your calling is to be present to these young people, not just to kind of be on the golf course outside of Arizona. So, but you're all here, so I'm preaching to the choir. I don't know what I would say if it was fall, and I could tell you already had your ticket sticking out of your pocket. You were heading to Arizona tomorrow. But you get my drift. You understand what I'm trying to say, how crucial it is that in our senior years we ask the question. So it may be in your line of work. I look at the young business people within our student. We have about 90 students in our business program. And I ache for them to have older businessmen and women, especially for the women, men and women, but as often as not, it's gender-specific, older men to younger men, older women to younger men, mentoring, encouraging, blessing. Whatever the line of work, I want to say to them, who are the older people, who are craftspeople, as teachers, as business people, as scientists, whatever your line of work, who are the older men in your life? I would not be here were it not for, and some of you know these names, Gordon Fowler, Bob Willoughby, and, okay, think of his name, just drew it, Don Bubna. Just, I'm pointing towards Peace Portal Alliance Church where I used to pastor. Without these three men, where would I be? These men blessed me. These men anchored me through the tenuous transitions of my life. These men were huge in my life, and now it's my time to turn and provide the same level of support and blessing to the next generation of young men. I'm asking six questions. I've asked three so far. Let me just pause here and see if there are questions, comments, observations that you would like to raise. If you have criticisms, those may be offered as well. Just keep in mind, I'm 63. It's a very tenuous time in a man's life, so go gently. I do want to ask one question. My brother Sawatsky raised the question in the break, and I just thought I'd respond to his, if I may go public with yours. But he said, Henry Nouwen said that ultimately I am the beloved one, quite apart from the quality and character of my work. Who I am matters most of all to God. And that, you know, just wondering how that fit with my opening comment, and I want to say unequivocally, my work is not a means of getting God to love me. My work is not a means of getting my significance established. My work is not a means of justifying or vindicating myself. I work as one who knows to the depth and core of my being that I'm loved. And I will often say to our faculty, the greatest gift you can give to your students is to begin your day in your morning prayers reaffirming that God loves you. And then you teach as one and you do good work as one who is loved. So just clarifying that point. But perhaps there's another question or comment. Yes, sir. All 12. I don't think there's any of... I'm a businessman, really, on the side. No. I'll suggest two, maybe three, at least. Depends on... Courage and Calling is the most kind of comprehensive. And then a year ago, a little book called Consider Your Calling, and it's the six questions you're looking at today. Those are the six chapters of that book. And then in my book, The Voice of Jesus, I have a chapter on the role of the Spirit in discerning vocation. So there's three different kinds of my books that kind of look at this topic. But Courage and Calling would be the most comprehensive. But depending on where your kids are at and how much reading they do and whether they only read if it's on Kindle might make a difference. Please. Did you everybody hear the question? He agreed with me entirely on the whole point about snowbirds. That's all I heard. No, everybody at that table knows that he said more. But is there not a place, he asked, is there not a place for rest? Is there not a place for Sabbath? And why not endorse those who want to be the snowbirds and go south to renew and replenish in order to be able to have that refreshment in order to come, my wording now, my paraphrase, in order to come back and be present to the next generation. The point of the matter is that the real vibrant part of congregational life happens between September and April, May. So if you're gone for more than half of that, you miss out on the rhythms, the routines. If you're not present for through the seasons of Advent and Christmas and those kinds of celebrations, you miss out on some of the most vibrant parts of the rhythms of a faith community that you're not present for. That is, that's the concern I have. And I think that in actual fact, yes, of course, my annual vacation is longer now than it was when I was in my 30s. It takes me more time to kind of replenish and bounce back and be refreshed. There's no avoiding, in a sense, that the aging of the human body requires more time for replenishment and renewal. I'm just saying it's this block period of time where you become part of a generation-specific community in Arizona. Just me and my peers complain about the weather and the government and what it is. And then we become generation-specific communities here because all the senior citizens have gone south right in the midst of the most vibrant part of our faith community's life. So I'm not questioning the need for rest for a moment. It's just this kind of broad-based abandonment. We're all going down together, basically to avoid the weather, rather than to ask the question, what is the work to which I'm called, whether or not? WHWE, yes?
Should we be spending more time on thinking about what work we're called to or working with the work we're doing? And then I can see you talk to a bunch of young people. For myself, I'll admit I really don't have a clue. Maybe I should by now. You were saying in the mid-30s, I'm already in my 50s. I have a few giftings for the most part, but self-survival, I go do a trade. I do very well with the trade. I really can't say that's what I was put here for. I know I do that through my God-given ability and people
Excellent.
Comment. I love your work. I get that everywhere, but whether that really means oh. that's where I should be or whether I should be searching out something that brings some fulfillment or just go along with purpose.
I'll ask for your card after if you're good at your trade. I may need it. I think it's the answer could be yes. That is, it's not necessarily yes or no. It could be that indeed, within my current sphere of work, I need to ask, how and in what ways has God called me to be present to what's been given to me? And I think oftentimes we create this idea, it was very much part of my religious upbringing as well. For those of us that went to kind of Canadian Bible College in those days, we had missionary meetings on Friday nights. And we were all being told we were going to be heroes to our generation and we were going to save the world in our generation because Jesus is coming back, if not on the weekend, by the end of the year. So we need to kind of go out and kind of save the world like now. And we're all going to be heroes for Jesus. It's exhausting. And I actually find that in actual fact, it's a form of hubris, a form of pride, rather than just saying, in humility, let's embrace the work that has been given to us. But I think oftentimes we can't do that because we've been given this idea that this is just ordinary work, that this is just mundane work. And in actual fact, most of the significant work that God is doing is through the mundane and the ordinary, the routine and the daily, and I need to be fully present to that. But at some point, a choice may not be there. You may be involved in a trade that now is no longer needed. You may be a taxi driver and Uber has now taken over your neighborhood. And now you're forced, in a sense, to look sideways, to say, well, now, given that the economy has changed or that Uber has unsettled my work, what will this mean for me? That is, sometimes we're not forced to change. And if there's a disquietude that is forming in your spirit, then have a friend or two, a conversation with a friend or two to say, should I be content and embracing what I'm doing? Or guys, should I be looking outside of what I'm doing? And to have those kind of trusted conversation partners, I think is invaluable at this stage of your life. But it may well be that God is calling you to be fully present to what you're doing and to do so with joy and alacrity and to be light and strength wherever God's called you. Yeah, I don't mean by any of my comments to unsettle. Fourth, yes, no. Please, yes, yes. Brilliant. Brilliant.
It's how you carry out the secular duties is going to be the determining factor. I was the most relieved new Christian ever.
Lovely. Thank you, Bob. Bless you. Fourth question. Yes. I see that hand. Sorry, I'm an evangelist at heart. Well, when Brian Solomon says to Micah, you're not an engineer, and I feel this is very, very awkward, older men are supposed to bless younger men, what are you doing? Brian had huge social capital with Micah. Brian could say anything. He had gained the trust of this young man. He knew that he loved him, and he could say it. And part of the power of older men with younger men is that you've got to develop that kind of social capital. You have to earn the right, in a sense, to say what needs to be said. And that's part of why the intergenerational communities, I need older men in my life even now who are able to kind of take me for the proverbial long walk on the beach and say, Gordon, what are you thinking in the way that you use power in your roles? And I need these older men in my life, and I have them. So you earn that trust and in that confidence. And I think Micah recognized it. Now, it may be that an older man says to me, Gordon, you should never have been a president. And I kind of suck it up and I say, well, okay, but I don't hear anybody else saying this because right now I have a kind of pretty high approval rating of just 51%, so what seems to be your problem. That is, we're going to have our critics, and I have my fair share of them, and you can't do the kind of work that I'm called to do, and that applies to many of you. You're in work in which you're going to have people who are underwhelmed by you, to put it too awkwardly. And we need to understand what that means and understand when somebody's not convinced that we're doing what we're called to be doing. When I was a pastor in the Philippines, the lowest possible job in the Philippines is filling gas. That's kind of viewed as the lowest of the low. And I had this woman who would just remind me regularly that I shouldn't be a pastor, I should be out pumping gas. She was completely underwhelmed by me. And I just had to kind of take the hit and realize you're not going to have, it's not a popularity contest. But I need to be discerning about who are those older men in my life who actually get me, understand me, and will bless me with discernment. got to have those relationships. That's what I meant by my line earlier. I would not be here were it not for those three older men. Fourth question, what are your life circumstances? As I said at the beginning this morning, God's call in your life is always particular to such a time as this. For many of you, I suspect that as you're hearing me this morning, part of what's crossing your mind is, ah, rats, I should have heard this 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it's too late. You're thinking to yourself, you don't understand, Mr. Smith, some decisions were made by my parents, by myself, by my employer, the man that fired me. I have been deeply wronged. I'm a victim. My life has passed me by. And now you're saying all of this, and what am I supposed to do with that? It's too late. And maybe it's even the phrase, if only, has crossed your mind this morning. If only this had not happened. If only this had not happened. If only I hadn't married her. If only, and you think now my life is just this, and it's well, how can I, what can I do with it? I want to, you know, a good speaker would not do what I'm about to do, would save the punchline for later on, but I can't resist, so I'm going to do it. You can see at the end of my notes, my punchline is the great benediction from the book of Ephesians, but I've got to go there quickly, lest I lose you, and you walk out and say, yeah, that's me. And that is the stunning language of Ephesians chapter 3, when he says, now to him who is able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine, according to his work of grace at work within us. Whoa. In other words, every time we're discerning what is the good work to which we are called, we're always doing so within the context of, Lord, this is the, well, these are the mess, the circumstances of my life. Here's what I've got to offer you. Now, within the light of what is, not what I wish was the case, but what is actually the case, Lord, what is your call in my life? And I love the line, the great line of Karl Rahner when he says, with God, there is no wasted time. With God, there is no wasted time. We take the past with all of the errors made by others or by ourselves, and we bring now these circumstances to our lives, and we ask, Lord, what is the good work you are calling me to now in light of what actually is the case? Not wishful thinking, but what is actually the case. We name our reality in a deeply hopeful way, which means also not only regrets about the past, but also no nostalgia about the past. It's basically useless. A number of years ago, Joelle and I were coming down the number one highway from Hope, and we were listening to the Canadian Broadcasting Company, and the CBC on that Saturday afternoon had something going on from the London Philharmonic Orchestra. Magnificent. I mean, it was just great. We had the radio up loud, and we're tooling down the number one highway, listening to the London Philharmonic, and then the narrator comes on at the end of one of the pieces and says, now, the conductor has invited the entire audience to stand, because the orchestra is going to lead them in a rendition of Britannia Rules the Waves. Well, my goodness, I almost felt like we should pull over to the side of the road and we should stand out there and sing with them, Britannia, Britannia, Britannia Rules the Waves. We didn't, but it was very moving. You could feel the hair on the back of your neck. This is very exciting. And then it's over. We turn the radio off. And Joella says, just this, but they don't. And I'm going, what do you mean, but they don't? But Britannia doesn't rule the waves. No, actually, they don't. Actually, it's been about a century since they ruled the waves. We need to call London pronto. That is, somebody needs to tell them, you don't, and it's been quite a while, just saying. that is, England or the UK will not function well on a global stage if they don't recognize the reality of what is the case rather than the nostalgic wish of what was the case. Do you understand what I'm trying to say? That is, rather than saying wishfully, we wish for a previous era, we wish for a golden age in the past, we need to learn how to name the reality that we are currently in as it actually is, not as we wish it were to be. Tomorrow, when I speak on the theme of Jeremiah 29, seeking the peace of the city to which I have sent you, part of what I want to speak about the fact is that we live now in a pluralist secular society. And I have no patience with nostalgia. Oh, for the good old days when Canada was a Christian nation. Oh, spare me. It's been a long time. Now, this is the society in which we live. How has God called us to be present now? Not nostalgic for a previous era, but present now. And it actually, I'm going to have the audacity to say, now maybe you won't come tomorrow, that maybe actually this is providential. The fact that the Belleville Alliance Church that I grew up with is now a mosque may actually be providential. That God is bringing the world to us. Whoa, what does that mean? It has huge implications. Rather than nostalgically of a previous era, we're the Christian country taking the gospel to the nations. Now the nations are coming to us. What does that mean? Could it actually be then rather than nostalgically a previous era, we embrace the current reality, and I say the same thing for you and me personally. That is, rather than looking back, now look to the future and ask, given the circumstances that are actually mine, and for every last one of us, there are circumstances we wish we could change. There's decisions that other people made or that you've made, that you wish you could rewrite, and you can't. It's gone. It's water under the bridge. And rather than getting melodramatic, we come to the text of Ephesians chapter 3 and we say, now to him who's able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine according to his work within us. And here's where I need my friends. They are very good. I have two man friends who just have this capacity to say, Gordon, am I hearing a little nostalgia there? Am I hearing a little if only? Ooh, you know, a little edge. And when you're in my kind of work, you're often thinking, if my predecessor hadn't done that, just how much easier my life could be. And if you're interested, we'll talk afterwards over coffee about what my predecessor did that now I have to live with. Just saying. Or could it be that, no, this is the circumstances. This is the location that God has placed this institution. I became the president in 2012. Now our circumstances have changed. And as I ask the question, what is the good work to which I'm called at this university, I'm answering that question differently now than I did 4 years ago because the circumstances have changed. The university circumstances have changed. The economy has changed, quite literally. You know what's happened in the Alberta economy. So much has changed in just 4 years. So now, rather than saying, I wish these Albertans were not so dependent on resource, well, you know, you can resist the speech, Gordon. It just is what it is. It's not a very profound way to put it. And now in light of what is God's call? What is God's call for me? What is God's call for the institution of which I'm a part? What is God's call for the church? We get rid of wishful thinking. We get rid of nostalgia. We get rid of what ifs. We stop viewing ourselves as victims and begin instead to say, now, given what is God's call upon my life? Now to him who's able to do immeasurably more than all we ask or imagine, according to his work at work within each one of us. Fifth question. Well, I gave you a heads up at the beginning of the day, at the beginning of the morning, that this question was going to come. We live within a society that assumes that if you experience difficulty, pain, and suffering, that it must mean that somehow you're doing something profoundly wrong, that you need to kind of fix it, you need to make it right. And a very influential voice in this regard is Stephen Covey, particularly his books, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. That book has no place for difficulty, suffering, pain, and disappointment. Any pain, suffering, setback, and disappointment you have is your own fault and the failure to observe good practices when it comes to career development. It is not the gospel. Jesus, not very successful at his work, I guess, says to his disciples, take up your cross and follow me. One of the most powerful exemplars of that, of course, is the Apostle Paul. And I often will go back to 2 Corinthians. It's the most autobiographical of his letters. It should be kind of off to the edge, you might say, for those. Are you ready to kind of go down to the depths? Because between chapters 2 and 7 of 2 Corinthians, it is not pretty. It's rhetoric. It's powerful rhetoric. It's brilliantly written, but it's not pretty. And then at one point, chapter 4, verse 15, well, I think that's the chapter and verse. It's in the inside column on the right side of the page, about halfway down, somewhere in there. When he says, death is at work in us, but life is at work in you. After he's described everything from shipwrecks to beatings, he uses that phrase, death is at work in us, but life is at work in you. What's he doing? He's using cross-resurrection language to speak about himself. And later on in 2 Corinthians, he speaks about the thorn in the flesh. And of course, we're all wondering, so what is this thorn in the flesh? And when I was a seminary student back in the 1970s, John Dom said to us, well, there's three different interpretations of the thorn in the flesh. And he says, well, there's a fourth, but I won't share it with you. And that was that it was his wife, but he didn't want to do that, so he came back to the three. These were the three things that he said were the thorn in the flesh. And we're not sure, we'll have to ask in the kingdom that is yet to come. I went as a missionary, as I said, to the Philippines. My colleague was Glenn Shellrood, who taught New Testament at the seminary. One day I walked down to his office and I said, Glenn, what's the thorn in the flesh in 2 Corinthians? And he says, well, there's six different interpretations. And he kind of rattled them off. Six, we're up to six, are we? Then a number of years later, I'm teaching here at Regent College. Across the hall from my office was Gordon Fee. He did a whole commentary on 1st and 2nd Corinthians, and he knows the Corinthian correspondence as well as anybody does, and so I waited a few weeks, you know, I didn't ask him the first day I met him. So one day, our offices are open, our doors are open, and we're chatting across, and I say, Gordon, while I've got you kind of distracted, can I just ask a quick question? I've always wondered, what is the thorn in the flesh that the Apostle Paul speaks about in 2nd Corinthians? Oh, Gordon, he says, there's probably at least a dozen different interpretations of the thorn in the flesh. You're just going to have to wait. Because, he says, we don't know, and maybe we're not supposed to know. Oh. So in the kingdom that is yet to come, we will ask. Now, I think there's going to be a huge lineup to talk to Paul. You've got your questions. I'm going to go straight to Luke, because I suspect Luke knew. So I'll ask Luke. And it's going to be a shorter lineup, so I just expect I'll go to Luke and say, so what was the thorn in the flesh? Good, it's what I thought it was. Joel is wrong. I can say I told you so to my wife now, because I got it right. But more to the point, this, it was a secret. That is, the Corinthians weren't meant to know. That is, in order for me to do my work with integrity and grace, I think there's something in the New Testament witness that suggests that pain, suffering, is going to intersect my life and my work. And that this will be the case for all of us. And that therefore it's appropriate for us to be able to ask, what is the cross that God has called you to bear? But you may not feel at liberty, and you don't need to tell me what is the cross that God has called you to bear. It's between you and perhaps those that are closest to you and between you and God. I will not tell you where I bear the cross of Christ. In a very real sense, we are not comparing the one to the other. In a very real sense, it's not your business. I bear it quietly. But my point is that the cross will intersect your life and your work. It is inevitably the case. For whatever reason, somehow when the cross intersects our lives, as Paul puts it in 2 Corinthians, it leads us to a greater level of dependence upon his grace. But it also is the very means by which God brings grace to others, death at work in us, life at work in you. My wife knows what the cross is, but she doesn't want me every evening over the dinner table, like, can I tell you about my cross today? And she says, well, what was it today? You know, no, I bear it quietly. She knows what it is, but the whole point is that we're not griping and complaining about this all the time, but we bear it quietly and winsomely. For some, your cross may be actually integral, inherent in your work. I sometimes like to think that if you think you're called to be a hockey goalie, but you don't like frozen black small spheres fired at you, you find that inconvenient, maybe that's not your calling. Just saying. That is, maybe that difficulty is not integral to you. That is, it could be that the cross is actually integral to the very work to which you're called. I say to pastors, you're going to have to live with church politics. If you don't like church politics, maybe, just saying, it's not your calling. That is, that goes with the terrain. It goes with the territory. It's part of the very fabric, in a sense, of the work to which you're called. But for others, your cross may actually be extrinsic, not intrinsic, but extrinsic, meaning it's the circumstances. Joel and I have an artist friend. She's also a single mother. She does her work as an artist from when the girls go to bed at night until she goes to bed at night. It's like an hour and a half, 2-hour window from 8 till 10. That's all. Otherwise, she's scrambling to put food on the table and raise these two girls, her two daughters. And I think her cross is that she does that with such grace, with such winsomeness. She never complains. And yet she feels, just as deeply as my wife does, that she's been called to be an artist. But rather than complaining about the circumstances within which she does it, she accepts with alacrity, with grace, this is the work to which I am called. And what this suggests to me is that we stop complaining about all the difficulties that intersect our life, our work, our careers, and our ministries. We stop viewing these as just a continual pain where we're complaining all the time about our work, and we say, no, no, part of doing our work well to the greater glory of God is accepting that indeed our work calls us into positions and circumstances that are challenging and difficult and require, as often as not, much patience, much grace, and as often as not, we shut the mouth and we don't complain. And then finally, oh, let me just say one more thing here. A friend of mine, known to some of you, was the dean of a theological school in Toronto a number of years ago for 1 year. He and I met at a conference in Chicago after he'd been in the role for 1 year, and he told me over at a Chicago pizzeria there, he told me that he was thinking of resigning. And I said, you've only been in the role a year. He says, yes, but it's just not going very well. Very, very difficult. And the politics of all of this, I can't handle. So I gave him a little speech on the role of the dean. And then I told him, as far as I'm concerned, you would make an excellent dean. I'm really surprised that you're letting this role go. You're letting this role go. And he said to me, Gordon, you know, that's your cross, but it's not mine. I have a different cross to bear. And as he spoke, I realized that indeed it is a different cross to bear. He had the choice, but it's a different cross. It isn't his cross to bear. And it may be that sometimes God says to us, my child, this is not who you're called to be. You're not, in a sense, it's not for you, in a sense, to carry this. Henry Nouwen did the same thing when he wrote his book, Gracias. He spent time amongst the favelas, the poorest of the poor in Lima, Peru, and realized after a season of time, this is not the cross that God has called me to bear, because he has not given me grace, in a sense, to bear this call. Just as an aside, something to consider. Sixthly, last question. Question number one, what on earth is God doing? Question number two, who am I? Question number three, what is my stage of life? Question number four, what are the circumstances for such a time as this of my life? Question number five, what is the cross that God has called me to bear? Question number six, what are you afraid of? The text that I've quoted there at the front, at the top of the sheet of paper that I've circulated with you, comes from 2 Timothy. Paul, the older man, writing to the younger man, he's already blessed him, and part of his blessing, the older man to the younger man, is these words, fan into flame the gift of God that is given to you through the laying on of our hands. Speaking of the formal blessing, older man to younger man, and then these words, for God has not given us a spirit of fear, can be translated timidity or cowardice, but a spirit of love, power, and self-control. Used to be that we used to think of, well, Timothy must have been a very timid man. And so now here's the older man trying to bolster him. But I wonder if in actual fact the language of fear, cowardice, and timidity, as over against courage, actually gets to the very heart of the matter. Will we have the courage to do what we are being called to do, or will fear keep us from fulfilling our vocations? You all know about the exchange between Jesus and Mary and Martha. It's a very brief little narrative in the Gospel of Luke. Paul obviously has a rapport, Jesus has a rapport and a relationship with these two women and their brother Lazarus. Jesus comes to visit. These are disciples, but they're disciples with an intimate relationship to him in the category of friends. And now there's a bit of a reprieve perhaps from the crowds as he drops in on the home of Mary and Martha. You know the story. Martha is busy in the kitchen preparing presumably the evening meal. Mary, in contrast to Martha, is at the feet of Jesus as disciple, as learner, as prayer. You know the story, but I'm going to give you a bit of a kind of a variation on that, my paraphrase. Martha is frustrated in the kitchen. If you are a chef, a cook, a kitchen worker person, then you understand there's a certain art to letting people know who are out in the living room and in the other areas of the house that you could use some help. There's a certain way that you accidentally bang the pots and pans, suggesting that indeed, hello, a little help in the kitchen would be in order. And if your wife, as the main kind of manager of the kitchen, is practicing this and you're not picking up the clues, pick them up sooner than later. She's signaling to you, I could use a little help. Anyways, there's ways to kind of signal that from the kitchen. If you do not succeed at that, you have no choice but to leave the kitchen and come out and say, I could really use a hand. So that's what she does. She comes out, or does she do that? Who does she want to help her? Mary. So she comes out of the kitchen and she speaks to Mary? No, she speaks to Jesus. She says to Jesus, tell Mary. Unbelievable. Here is somebody telling the second person of the Trinity, the Lord of glory, how to manage the universe. She is actually uses the imperative. She says, tell Mary to come help me. Mary's the problem, but rather than speaking to Mary, she speaks to Jesus and tells. So she has a problem with both of them. That is, both of you are kind of underwhelming me right now. Neither of you are fulfilling your calling, and I have a good read on what it is you're both supposed to be doing. One, you're supposed to be helping me with the kitchen, and two, you are supposed to be telling her to help me out with the kitchen. I know this is not, this is a lot, none of this is in the text, but you know, much of it's there. You know, you get the gist of it. There's a technical phrase for this, actually. It's called triangulation. With rather than speaking to the person you're supposed to be speaking to, you speak to somebody else, and you speak about the other person, even though she's there, in the third person. That is, tell Mary. Mary, Jesus says, I'm sorry. I heard you banging the pots out there. Mary, go help your sister. You know, work with me in here. This is what you need to do. No, he doesn't. He responds to Martha, and he says, oh, Martha, Martha. He says her name twice, interestingly enough. There used to be a time when I said, you never want the Lord to say your name twice. You know that what's coming next can't be good. But in actual fact, Martha would have immediately recognized, you'll see this all through the Old Testament, whenever a name is said twice, it's always has a vocational implication. Calling is now on the table. Oh, Martha, Martha, and then these words, you are anxious and worried about many things. Wow. He gets immediately to the heart of the matter. The heart of the matter is not what Mary's supposed to be doing or Martha's supposed to be doing. The heart of the matter is you are anxious and worried about many things, and consequently, you're not embracing your call, and you're frustrated with everybody else, both me and Mary. The heart of the matter is that she's anxious and worried. That is, could it be that the greatest obstacle to the fulfillment of your vocation is not external to you, but internal to you? Will you have the courage to do what you are being called to do? Just over 5 years ago, I was attending a conference in San Francisco, staying with people, some of you would know them, Glenn Scorgi, some of you would have taught by Glenn Scorgi. I was rooming with Glenn, and another friend of mine, David Bouchard, was at the same conference of theologians. Ambrose University was looking for a president, but it was actually something that was marginal to me. I really enjoyed the work that I was doing, viewed it as actually strategic and timely, and that I was kind of cut out for this. And the work that we were doing, particularly to relaunch a theological seminary in Hanoi, was for me deeply animating and gratifying. So I was glad to be part of that work. I went out for dinner that evening with my friend Glenn Scorgi. We room together at this conference every year. So we get into our room, out we go for dinner, little Italian restaurant, sat at the table. We barely ordered our dinner, and Glenn says, Gordon, I need to ask you, are you a candidate for the presidency of Ambrose University? And I kind of laughed. No, Glenn, I'm not a candidate. He says, you should be. You've got this, this, and this. You've got this experience. You could be good at this. You should throw your name in the hat. Thank you, Glenn. That's very flattering. That's very kind. But no, I really like what I'm doing. So, you know, it's not something. I think maybe 2 or 3 years ago I might have been interested. But now, you know, it's water under the bridge. It's behind. They've moved on. I've moved on. No. Fine. We had a lovely dinner together. Next evening, same restaurant, same table with David Bouchard. He and I were colleagues at Canadian Theological Seminary. Same routine happens. We order our meal, and then David says, I've got to ask. And by this time, I wondered, he's not going to say the same thing as last night. And sure enough, David says to me, just curious, are you considering, have you tested the waters with Ambrose? Are you going to put your name in the hat? And I gave the very same speech. And for what it's worth, I could give that speech now, and you'd all wonder, he's abandoned his calling, because I would have spoken very powerfully about what I was doing, my deep conviction that this was the right thing for me to do. It was all like, hello, I was in the center of God's will, if you're understanding that kind of language. After dinner, we walk back to the Hilton, we walk into the atrium, and I think the issue is done. And then David reaches over and puts his hand on my arm and says, I just have to ask you one more question regarding Ambrose University. What are you afraid of? And I, you know, what do you do when somebody asks you that question? So I ask, the follow-up question is, what do you mean? That's what I, you know, that's the, what do you mean? And he says, well, I'm not sure what I mean. I just think, I heard you, but I just think you need to answer that question. Well, I went upstairs and went to the hotel room and do the kind of requisite things of kind of getting ready for the evening, for bed. And at the end of my day, whenever I'm traveling, I phone Joella, and I kind of, ha, 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 just had this conversation with these two guys, Glenn last night, and then David Bouchard tonight, And then David tonight, right downstairs in the hotel, he says to me, can you believe it? He asked me, what am I afraid of? And there's silence on the phone. And Joella says, well, I think he's asking you the right question. What do you mean? I say, you know, that's what do you mean? He's asking me the right question. Well, she says, I'll talk more when you come home, but I think you need to ask the question, what is it that you're afraid of? And indeed, as soon as she spoke it, echoing the words of David, I realized that in some very real sense, I had blocked out the deep fear that I had to let my name stand for this role. Obviously, on some level, I've addressed it, but for what it's worth, that same fear hounds me now. It's just in the margins, almost every day. Every day, I could easily be the kind of person that Jesus would say to me also, Gordon, you are anxious and worried about many things, but one thing in particular. Every day, I have to cast that care upon him who cares for me. Every day, I have to pray the prayer of Philippians 4, be anxious for nothing, but receive the peace that transcends all understanding. Every day, I love the language of Henry Nouwen on this point when he says, our fears and anxieties will never always be gone, but we can at least tell them to go get over in the corner and beat on them when they ever they try to leave the corner. Because in actual fact, they will hound us and they will inform our work if we let them. What is the fear that might keep you from doing what you are being called to do? And indeed, one of the things that as older men, part of our ministry to younger men, is the ministry of encouragement. That is, of granting them the grace to fight the fears, to face the fears, to name the fears, to calm the fears, that indeed would keep them from doing with them what they are called to do. That is, we need that encouragement because of the power of fear to keep us from fulfilling the work that God has called us to, what God has called us to be and what God has called us to do. I find it fruitful to be very honest on this point. That is, if you look at my personal journal, my spiritual journal, about every fifth page talks about fear, anxiety, every fifth page. And I find it, by bringing it out, by naming it, it actually cauterizes, it not so much cauterizes it, it diminishes its power. It isn't gone, it doesn't eliminate it, but it diminishes its power. I've made reference along the way to conversation partners. Let me conclude by saying this. This is one of the big questions you need to ask. What is the good work to which I'm called? It's one of the big ticket items. You need to do this and do it well. But you cannot do it alone. You simply cannot answer those six questions alone. You cannot answer those six questions if you are in isolation, if you are in solitary relationships, if you are not in community. You have to have, on all six of these questions, I've tried to illustrate it with each one of these six. I needed David to ask me the question, what are you afraid of? The fact is he was a peer, but either way, what I've tried to illustrate is that for each of these six questions, we need other people with whom we're in conversation, the people we have the proverbial long walk on the beach with. And you don't need many, but I wonder if at the very least you need three. That is, think about the possibility of these three. At least one older man in your life, at least one person, a generation older than yourself, not your father, maybe an uncle, but an older man who loves you, believes in you, respects you, and will challenge you. An older man who indeed will be present to you as a counselor, advisor, perhaps in the same line of work as yourself. You're a young business person, an older man in business. You're a young pastor, an older man who's a pastor. But you've got at least one person who's a generation older than yourself. And then secondly, that you've got one person at least who's a peer within your line of work. That is, the two of you get together to talk about doing business or doing education or doing art or whatever it is that you're called to do. You've got one person who's a peer where indeed there's a cone of silence. I have lunch this coming week with Gary Nelson. He's the president of Tyndale University. And I know he loves to say it, so I know he's going to say it when we sit down for lunch. Gordon, cone of silence. Yes, Gary, cone of silence. And it's just rich. We can both talk about our work in ways that we almost want to say nobody else quite gets what it means to be the president of a Christian university in such a time as this. And Gary and I, we're not competitors, we're peers, we're colleagues. We have each other's back. It's rich. And then I also find that I need one person who's not in my line of work. And later on this afternoon, you know him, Brian, from your former congregation. It's Cal Buss, businessman, works for Deloitte. I love connecting with this man. He's in business. He's a peer. He's my age, a little bit younger. But he doesn't understand my line of work. He doesn't understand theological education or university education or academic administration. He's an accountant, bless his heart. Sorry. He has a whole range of different sensibilities. He sees things differently. I need him. I need precisely that. I need that conversation partner. I'm suggesting a minimum of three, one generation older, one a peer in your line of work, one a peer outside of your line of work. If you have more, great, but you don't need very many more. And it may be that the kind of people you should be talking to are here this morning. That is, that one of the outcomes of this morning's kind of time together is you're seeing across the room somebody that, you know what, he and I should be getting together for coffee every 3 weeks. And over coffee, we get to the heart of the matter quickly. How's it going? How's your work? What's bringing you joy? What's bringing you sorrow? And go to that right away. Go to the emotional quotient right away. What's bringing you joy and what's bringing you sorrow? And how can you be a means of encouragement to one another? And you won't necessarily ask these six questions, you know, what is God doing? And who are you? Aha. Uh-huh. And what is your stage of life? You realize now you're 63. You know, you heard him, 63. And now, what is your cross? And now, no, not necessarily. But these six questions will swirl around the conversation. And when somebody's not handling stress and difficulty well, a good friend will challenge that. Will challenge him to say, maybe you need to bear that graciously and more winsomely and more patiently. And most powerfully at all, it's with our friends that we can talk about fear, anxiety, and worry. If we don't have anyone in our life to talk to about our fears, our anxieties, and our worries, we try, but we can't, we try to carry them alone. It's the conversation partner that actually diminishes the power of fear and grants us the capacity to live with encouragement for such a time as this. So my last word to you is to find that grace of grace-filled conversation with others, and maybe it will arise out of even somebody else that's here in the room. I know it's awkward. If you're thinking to yourself, I need to have an older man that I'm talking to, and I see some here, if I go by the color of their hair or the lack thereof, that maybe could be that. Like, what am I supposed to do? Just walk up to them and say, could you pay for coffee? Could you bless me? Or like, what are you supposed to do? This is very awkward. So, yeah, I know it's awkward. So just deal with it. That is, life's too short. Deal with it. Older men expect to be approached by younger men to say, could we do coffee? Maybe they've heard you speak here at the church. Maybe they've heard you say something in a committee meeting, a boardroom meeting here at the church. Maybe they've watched you from a distance and you become to them somebody that they would like to kind of have a conversation with. That is, we've got to get past that awkwardness to develop the warmth of relationships and the friendships that will happen intergenerationally. And expect somebody to approach you to say, hey, you were at that seminar that Smith led. Six of his questions, I'm not sure about them. In fact, I disagree with five of them, but so what? Let's have a conversation. And you may differ with me on all of it, but if the net result is you've got a good conversation partner out of today, it was worth the effort. Gentlemen, God bless you, each one. Thanks for hearing me out, and God go with you. Amen.